This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Today, governments are facing very serious, seemingly intractable public management issues that go to the core of effective governance and leadership, testing the very form, structure, and capacity required to meet these problems head-on. Complex challenges, or so-called wicked problems, tend to have innumerable causes and are hard to define, making their mitigation resistant to predetermined solutions or traditional problem-solving approaches. Since complex challenges confront people with the unknown and unpredictable, they also demand a different style of leadership, one that shapes vision and fosters alignment and commitment through collaborative action. Depending on the challenge faced, government leaders may need to fundamentally transform how their organizations operate to meet mission. For example, when facing the challenge of budget cuts and significant resource reallocation, transformational change that can deliver mission value more efficiently will be increasingly important. What is transformational leadership? How have government leaders successfully led transformational change? When should government leaders consider undertaking transformation initiatives? Today we will explore these questions and so much more with Bob Reasoner, author of the recent IBM Center report, A Leader's Guide to Transformation, Developing a Playbook for Successful Change Initiatives. Welcome, Bob. It's good to have you on the program.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Also joining our conversation from IBM is Bill Takis. Bill, welcome back. It's great to have you.
Nice to see you again.
Bob, given your research, what is meant by transformation?
Well, what transformation literally means is the change from one form to a new form, and it retains the DNA, the properties of the former being, is what transformation is all about. And in government, it has become a popular term during the last decade in talking about the kinds of dramatic changes that are needed in government today.
So an important aspect of your report, actually the key aspect of your report, is the introduction of transformational leadership. You've defined what transformation is, but can you tell us a little bit about transformational leadership, and more specifically, who will be tomorrow's transformational leaders?
Well, the way in which the research was conducted was to interview eight different, and ultimately we reached out to 10 different leaders who were transformational leaders, who were recognized by experts in the field as having led important transformational initiatives or having had experiences that were particularly going to give us insight. And what we were seeking to do was to learn from them and to gain from their experience, to have them tell us their stories. But what is clear is that tomorrow's transformational leaders may come from any part of the organization. It isn't going to be the organization chart that defines who leads transformational initiatives. It may well come from a constituency that's the driver of a transformational change.
And with that, because of the conversations you've had, the folks you've interviewed, the profiles you put in the report, what steps should be taken to ensure successful transformation? And more to the point, what is mission value and how essential is it for leaders to focus on creating mission value?
Well, let me begin with mission value because it's a concept that was introduced to me in a recent monograph that was written by Chuck Pro of IBM. But he put his finger on something that I think, through my experience in Washington and with governmental agencies, is particularly important, which is defining value, defining the concept of what is creating value for a public leader? And so what mission value is specifically is it's a concept that notes that you can get to creating value through either of two pathways. One pathway is creating new value or improving the quality of services, delivering service, or at the same time you can increase value by cutting costs and by improving efficiency. Now, it was presented as a more or less a formula. By cutting those costs in the denominator, you could increase the value overall, or by increasing the numerator. But the idea that this mission value is both concepts was something that came through in the interviews with these transformational leaders, and a point that was referred to by a number were that it couldn't simply be cutting costs to create transformation. It couldn't simply be creating new services, especially in this time of budget cuts and resource constraints.
It's very interesting what you're talking about with regards to mission value. Now, when you talk to the individual leaders in your report, what were the key elements that they felt were very important or essential in creating that meaningful change? And how did they go about sustaining that change over the long term, not just a quick change, but a long-term, very systematic change?
Well, one of the things, Bill, as you know, as we talked about the research over the last 2 years, was we were trying to get the ideas from the leaders themselves. We were trying to get what we called a playbook, where individual leaders would talk to us about what had worked well for them. And what was striking to me across a lot of different interviews was how they all talked about five basic elements. There's a part of this which has to do with the plan, with deciding what to do. There's a part of it which has to do with part of successful transformation that has to do with aligning that plan with the mission of the agency. There's a part as well which is absolutely critical, which has to do with innovation and anticipating the future. There's a part that has to do with strategic implementation. And then finally, in sustaining this transformation process. And the sustaining is an interesting point because it's not only the concern of leaders to be sure that what they achieve is transferred and stays with these agencies over time, but also the recognition that the forces that are driving change and transformation are not going away, that the same force that drove the need to transform is going to drive the perpetual need to continue to transform over time.
Well, I thank you for explaining the concept of the playbook, because as I read the report, it's very interesting how you brought that out and made it come alive from your experiences with speaking to the folks.
Well, it really was their playbook. It's their plays and their concepts about what leads to success.
Let me rewind the tape a little bit here and go back to the beginning. What made you really think about doing this type of a report? And what made you want to think about these research in this particular area? And why did you speak to the people that you did? And how did you pick them?
Yeah. Well, the reason for my interest in transformation, and Bill, you and I share this a little bit, and that I know you've worked extensively with the Postal Service, was that in the mid-90s, I was a consultant and I was recruited by Marvin Runyon and Bill Henderson, who was his then working for Marvin. Bill was his successor as Postmaster General. And I had this opportunity to go to work for the Postal Service. And the Postal Service is a leader in having had to run into the problem of having had to transform its institution. The Internet delivered a challenge to the Postal Service that is almost unlike challenges that face a lot of other agencies. And so over time, as I ultimately became vice president for strategic planning at the Postal Service, this idea of the transformation of public institutions is naturally something that I was interested in and have been studying really for the last 20 years almost.
Well, and I look forward to talking with you a little bit more about the Postal Service and its transformation in a few moments. How did you pick the individual leaders that you did for the study?
Well, it was very much a product of collaboration with the Center for the Business of Government. There have been a number of leaders that their magazines and radio shows like this one and blogs and meetings and quite a range of activity that the center's involved in that were engaging various leaders across the government and in collaborating with them. Bill, you may remember you and I both talked to them about who would be good subjects for this study, and it came from a nomination process from IBM's experience and the leaders of various accounts, as well as the individuals in the center.
Bob, you've given us a wonderful sort of tee-up of the report and why you pursued this kind of research area. And you alluded to a little bit about your background, but I'd like for you to tell us a little bit more about your career path, a little bit about yourself.
Well, I have been in Washington. My wife probably would say I'm unable to escape Washington since the 70s. When I got the experience that I just referred to of working on transformation at the Postal Service, I recognized at some point along that process that this was probably about the sixth time that I'd been involved in major transformations that involved the government. What brought me to Washington was I was at Harvard Business School and got a chance to work on for the Ash Council on Government Reorganization when the Environmental Protection Agency was being created. And so watched what was then an enormous transformation from a society that allowed businesses to create externalities to a sense of public interest. It was a change that was profound and became even more interesting when the energy crisis threw a new light on energy and the environment. I left government in 1976 to teach at the Yale School of Management and to be a management consultant, which is something that I continued to do until I got this phone call from a recruiter who was working for Marvin Runyon. And that drew me back into the government again.
What are the five steps to transformation? We will explore this question and so much more when the special edition of the Business of Government Hour, A Conversation with Authors, returns. This is The Center This Week, highlighting the latest trends and best practices for improving government effectiveness. Brought to you by the IBM Center for the Business of Government. I'm Michael Keegan, Managing Editor of the Business of Government magazine. The Center This Week is our opportunity to inform and, most importantly, to invite you, our listeners, to use the IBM Center for the Business of Government as your resource, a how-to resource for improving government effectiveness at the state, local, and federal level. This week, we'll focus on leadership and public service with Dan Tanglerini, Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Management and Chief Financial Officer. Here's Dan on leadership and public service.
Well, I actually think that there are some just basic principles that work at any level. Remember to know what you don't know. I mean, to really spend some time with the people who do the work and continually ask them for ideas and suggestions and ways that you can do it better. The trick is to try to set some vision, to try to give people some sense of what the mission is, to give them some sense of ownership and participation, and then to turn them loose, trust them, and support them if they make mistakes. I mean, one of the ways you can determine whether people are actually pushing and doing anything is if they're actually making some mistakes. If you do nothing, you're probably not going to make a single mistake. And so I think that that's one of the biggest challenges for government in general. We have a zero tolerance kind of approach to mistakes. The federal government, it seems even starker just because any mistake can be magnified and politicized so dramatically. So that's the one difference, I think, in the local government is that you have a little bit more room for experimentation. And I think you see that really in terms of the way state and local governments are in many ways kind of leading on some of the approaches, the new approaches to the way government can deliver services. So the federal government, I think, then benefits from that environment. We can steal a lot of their great ideas and see how we can employ them in the federal government as well.
That was Dan Tanglerini, Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Management and Chief Financial Officer. More information on this and other Center resources is available at businessofgovernment.org. There you will find how the business of government is not business as usual. For the IBM Center for the Business of Government, I'm Michael Keegan, and this has been The Center This Week. What are the seven management imperatives all government executives need to know? How is DOD improving its business operations? What is FAA's Next Generation Air Transportation System, or NextJet? How is New York City shaping a government that is customer-focused, innovative, and more efficient? And what about power, security, and leadership in the 21st century? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors, exploring ideas to improving government effectiveness. My guest today is Bob Reasoner, author of the recent IBM Center report, A Leader's Guide to Transformation, Developing a Playbook for Successful Change Initiatives. Also joining us from IBM is Bill Takis. So, Bob, five major themes emerge as transformational leaders who you profile in your report describe the basic steps that they took to launching and implementing major change initiatives. So these five themes, and you alluded to them earlier, before we delve into each theme, would you highlight some of the key questions leaders must pose and answer prior to launching these types of initiatives?
Well, one of the things that's interesting about talking to transformational leaders today is that a decade ago, I think we all had the experience of it being clear that there needed to be change. When the internet began to transform the way in which business was done and people communicated, the idea that you needed to invest was clear. Today, there's much more emphasis on and much greater need to think about what worked and what didn't and whether to launch and when to launch. And so I think that there's a lot of attention at the front end to what should be the nature of our transformation and how do I tee this up? Particularly, how do I create phases and how do I think about the timing and sequencing of actions that I need to take? So it's more than planning. It's really a larger sense of what do I need to do? How do I need to get my staff ready to do it? Maybe how do I build infrastructure that's needed in order to make this successful?
Does the question of is the organization mature enough factor into it in order that they can sustain the change, as Bill was alluding to in the previous segment, the idea of making this change sustainable through time?
Well, I think that's right, although, you know, we tend to think about the concept of an organization being mature and sort of we all tend to be glib and move past that quickly. Maturity has lots of dimensions to it, as does this some of the mechanisms that some of the leaders talked to me about that had to do with sustaining transformation. One of the things I found most interesting was a leader who I thought was doing some of the most controversial things. And I, in effect, was given the privilege of asking him the wise guy question about, you know, here are all these controversial things you're doing, but how do you know that they're going to be here next week after you leave? And he was very conscious of that. And what he was talking about was building a user group, building a constituency around the changes that a lot of people would agree were important, but we're going to be hard to keep going.
So these leaders, because of what they're engaging in, are running up against tough calls. They have to make tough calls. To what extent do they need a core structure that guides their actions? And if they do need this core structure, what does it look like?
Well, I think that there is a sense that there needs to be a compelling plan. We talk to leaders that range across the spectrum of the federal government. People were generous with their time from the Department of Homeland Security to the Veterans Administration to the State Department to the Postal Service. And as people talk to us, this issue that I just mentioned of the sequencing of activity and how to tee that up became particularly important in the sort of lore of transformation and in government. Frequently, people tend to find that it's so hard to get action at all that it's helpful, and we all confess to it having been helpful, that there was a burning platform that got to be a fire starter. But That may not be the smartest way to go about getting successful transformation. It may be in a given agency that it's critical to have staff that are ready to carry out the transformation. It may be that there's infrastructure that's critical to carrying it out effectively, or any number of things. Heaven forbid, that there are customers of the agency that need to be ready to accept the change. And while we may see that it's imperative to make a change, if the customers aren't ready for the change, it can undermine the good work that's done. And so I think at the front end, this compelling plan has to do with these issues that I just mentioned of thinking about timing.
That's very interesting, Bob, because most people would think that when you are faced with a compelling urgency to change, you have a burning platform to make that change. Can you go into that a little bit more about how important that is? Because you kind of threw that a little bit on its ear. But
in one place that you and I both have shared some experience in working with the Postal Service, it is an absolutely classic case of an issue that a professor at Harvard Business School, Clayton Christensen, has talked about when he wrote his book, The Innovator's Dilemma. And he's written a number of books and spawned a great deal of thought about that since. What he talks about is the difference between sustaining technologies and incremental change to fundamental change, disruptive change. Now, in a case like the Postal Service, as we know, it was an instant. Just recently, the Postmaster General said that this is not a sustainable business proposition, that it's a very large place that has high costs, and yet its customers have been changing the nature of what they wanted from the Postal Service. So it was a case where there was a driving need for change, and yet the customers may not be there yet. They may not be ready for that kind of disruptive change. What happens is customers aren't ready for the disruptive change until it's too late. And that was, I think, the point that Christensen made. And so it has a lot to do with thinking about the nature of transformational change and how important it may be to think it through up front.
When we think about strategic change, we think about oftentimes how leaders have to act with strategic intent and how they have to align that change with a very rigorous definition of their overall mission. Can you talk a little bit about that aspect of transformation?
Well, the idea of alignment is something that just came up in interview after interview. And I think there are a number of things that were driving that. First of all, that government agencies today are complicated, interactive entities, and constituents, and everyone has constituencies, and because of the transparency and the fact that that technology has enabled constituencies, government agencies are interactive, and the constituencies have voices about what's important to them. So to lead in this kind of a complicated environment where you need to make difficult communications to multiple layers within the organization and multiple different entities, it's particularly important to start with that mission. Mm-hmm. And that mission, which is often given by Congress and redefined by overseers, becomes the core from which the actions of the agency then can be defined and can enable change.
Well, Bob, you mentioned that engaging constituencies, stakeholders, is critical in order to make a successful transformation sustainable. So transformations cause change, and pain is the result of such change. How, from your research, what findings, what lessons learned did the executives give you in terms of the best ways to engage stakeholders throughout the process?
Well, in some ways, it's a very exciting degree of change that's taking place that has to do with the places that government has been open and has been enabling constituencies to interact. One of the leaders that I talked to was in charge of creating that kind of enablement. And it's dramatic how fast someone within an agency can create a blog or can communicate with constituencies. What we're all thinking through, though, is that there are security issues, there are privacy issues, there are any number of management issues that get raised. as that kind of constituency interaction is facilitated. And the importance of engaging the constituencies is both naturally something that you need to do in order to make these transformational changes successful, but also I think it's wrong to believe that you can lead change of this kind and not have the constituencies interacting. The same technology that makes it possible for them to interact with the agency makes it possible for them to interact with one another. In an agency of social platforms, there's no reason that constituencies can't find common cause. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes critical to be successful to have that kind of engagement taking place at every stage in the process.
You spoke before about some work by Clay Christensen around innovation and the importance of innovation in transformational change. How important is innovation play in driving change through very complex government agencies that we're talking about here, federal agencies?
Well, the question of transformation is wrapped around the question of innovation, because innovation is the way in which someone defines the change, the future. And while it may be hard in government to imagine that change is going to, or innovation is going to result from a visionary leader who's going to hand down what the future is going to look like. And in an interactive world like the one that I just was describing, that you could see in these interviews where these leaders of transformational change were interacting with multiple constituencies, it isn't as if someone can hand down this is what the future is going to be like and have everyone fall in line. But it is that certainly creating a process of change and innovation that everyone can believe in, that has integrity and that can gain legitimacy by having it incorporate the views of constituents, it means that successful transformation is centered by that notion of innovation.
And these efforts can be, you know, challenging to lead and quite subtle to manage efficiently and effectively. So I'd be interested, given your research, given the conversations you had with these government executives, what were some of their prescriptions on how to use best practices, assemble joint teams, ownership, and maximizing consensus in order to help drive these transformational initiatives?
Well, it's interesting that you bring up best practices, because one of the interviewees that we profile in the book was Richard Spires, who's the CIO of the Department of Homeland Security. And he described to me a problem that's not necessarily unique to Homeland Security, but certainly it's characteristic, where an agency that was created only in 2003 is brought together with 20 different sub-agencies, each with their own information systems, some of them technologies, some of them highly secure, some of them dependent upon emergency response, and trying to integrate agencies, to create integrated data centers, to do the kinds of change that was ultimately necessary. The point that he makes is it's not that people are resisting integration, it's they're trying to do their job well. And the idea that something as critical to your job as information technology might be something that was going to change is a difficult challenge that everyone has to cooperate on. In that case, it was by using best practices, by talking about what is a best practice, that I think Richard felt that he was able to get collaboration around changes that was difficult for everybody.
What other tactics did these leaders give you in terms of that you could offer in your research that suggests how you can make a implementation process successful? What are some of the tactics that they used that were successful?
Well, one of the things that struck me was I just talked a minute ago about innovation, mm-hmm. and how innovation needs to center the transformation process. One of the things that struck me was you can't allow it to be marginalized, though. And it's so easy to create a little cadre of young Turks that are charging toward change, and where the core organization, in effect, can say, look, we have to do business day to day. We have to keep the lights on here. You guys go think about this innovation stuff. And it tends to not bring it into the core of the agency. And so the idea that you might need to create collaborative teams that have line managers and Young Turks on the same team. Not only is the Young Turk more likely to learn a few lessons about how to get the change to work in the agency, but also there's ownership of the change on the part of the core establishment. And it's not that the agency doesn't see the need to change. When I was recruited at the Postal Service, it was dramatic how many line managers who had been there for many years had been seeing the internet, in effect, coming and knew what kind of change electronic technology was going to mean for their core business, and how they celebrated the idea that Marvin Runyon was drawing in someone who was going to try and lead the creation of a digital strategy. But it doesn't mean that we were successful in creating that kind of integration that I just described.
What lessons can be learned from successful transformational leaders? We will explore this question and so much more when the special edition of the Business of Government Hour, A Conversation with Authors, returns. What is FAA's Next Generation Air Transportation System, or NextGen? How is the U.S. Department of Homeland Security turning its one DHS vision into a reality? What is New York City doing to shape a government that is customer-focused, innovative, and more efficient? And how is the DoD improving its business operations? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Hear from FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt, DHS Undersecretary for Management Raphael Boris, New York City Deputy Mayor for Operations Stephen Goldsmith, and Dave Winogrand, Assistant Deputy Chief Management Officer at DoD. Professor Joseph Nye and General Anthony Zinni on power, security, and leadership in the 21st century, and seven management imperatives that government leaders should pursue to be successful in an era of fiscal constraint. All of this and so much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors, exploring ideas to improving government effectiveness. My guest today is Bob Reasoner, author of the recent IBM Center report, A Leader's Guide to Transformation, Developing a Playbook for Successful Change Initiatives. Also joining us from IBM is Bill Takis. Bob, I'd like to delve into some of the insights offered by the various government leaders you interviewed as part of your research. Over the last few years, the U.S. Department of the Treasury has faced a critical period of mission review, and you had the opportunity to speak with Dan Tengelarini, Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Management. He's also their Chief Information Officer and Chief Performance Officer. Would you tell us more about what you learned from Dan about his efforts at Treasury, and how has he sought to address the challenge of resource constraints, and to what extent has his leadership focused on mission definition and return to basics?
Well, Dan was very interesting to talk to because he and the Deputy Secretary have been focused on an issue that I think is a concern across the government, which is the how to deal with budget constraints, how to deal with resource limits, and how to begin to think more rigorously about the missions of individual parts of a diverse agency. You're absolutely right. There are new things that Treasury, the consumer protection responsibilities, the Dodd-Frank responsibilities. So there have been new legislative changes that Treasury has had to take on. But even within some of its traditional core functions, the IRS and others, there are major management challenges faced by Treasury. And in talking with Dan, he talked about the challenge of having to sit across the table from someone who has many different responsibilities and to find a common ground in how to pare that back. And this is something that government leaders are going to face across the government. And the idea of starting with mission and beginning with what is the mission, it's not as if any of us might have gotten into what we all jokingly refer to as mission creep, where we've done extra things for the wrong reasons. Often that kind of thing can happen because you're serving a constituency who has a need. And it's not as if in this time of resource constraint that we're going to have those constituencies or those needs disappear. And so it's going to be well to have concern for how people are going to solve these problems. But at the same time, and particularly in an agency where you've got new responsibilities, this concept of mission can be a key driver in creating collaboration around change.
Well, I know from the report it referenced something akin to return to basics. What was Dan and what was your conversation around that?
Well, I think that what Dan gave some examples of various agencies, which, you know, he was just talking about individual cases of a story of someone who had gotten into wide-ranging concerns that had to do with the employees of the agency or the customers of the agency. And it's because none of us as customers of government have just a narrow focus on receiving, a particular benefit. We have complex lives and government agencies that have programs that seek to interact with us tend to react to our needs. Now, what that means over time is that you have diverse challenges that get incorporated in the budget and in the agency responsibility. And I think that it's tough for senior leadership and performance officers and line managers to come to agreement about how they're going to make cuts because there are people involved, starting with the mission, starting with the oversight. What the law said, what the Congress directed is probably the best guide for handling that kind of a challenge.
I just have one quick follow-up. Dan wears almost three different hats within his department. When you were speaking with Dan for your research, did he illustrate any of the challenges that he was facing in any of those three particular
hats? Well, in your earlier question and in talking about it, that's a change that involves both performance and budget. So CFO and chief performance officer coming together there over a particular kind of challenge. The challenges of performance improvement are going to range widely, and they won't be limited strictly to budget challenges. Dan also talked about the importance of the constituencies. Dan had another experience that he brings to Treasury, which is in addition to having worked for the Office of Management and Budget, he also worked for the City of Washington, D.C., and for the Transportation Department. So Dan's got an experience with working with individuals who had needs at the level of which subway train do I take next. And so when we talked about technology, he was talking about the experience of opening technology to the constituents and the kinds of applications that got created in the City of Washington. That was called Democracy Apps. Mm-hmm. And the opening of data, democratizing data. It's a very interesting set of stories. It's not directly related to Treasury and to the story of mission that I was talking about, but it certainly shows you the way in which it's possible to open up innovation to new contributors in the modern era.
It's very interesting how you talked about where Dan has brought together that need to balance performance improvement with overall cost control and how that's come together. I wanted to turn the conversation back to the Postal Service. I know you, as you said before, you interviewed Pat Donahoe, who is the Postal Service Postmaster General currently, and he has had a very successful track record of bringing together that notion of improving service performance over time with the need to balance costs and to reduce costs overall. And he's made tremendous strides in both of those areas. Can you tell us a little bit about what Pat's been doing in that area?
Well, one of the each of these interviews, you end up with something that struck you as a powerful insight that was given to you by one of these leaders. And Pat Donahoe in particular said something that I found striking. He talked about earning the privilege of changing. and the need to deliver service to customers so that he could help them understand the change. And you can understand that completely when you see the kinds of bold proposals that he's made recently in order to create a postal service that is going to be a viable institution in 2015. He's recently put forward the notion that the Postal Service needed to rethink its operating network and that it needed perhaps to cut from almost 500 facilities that are processing mail to perhaps as few as 250. Now, whatever the number is that gets decided in the long run, the idea that there could be a significant reduction in the number of facilities is the kind of big change that customers inevitably are going to say, oh, how is that going to affect me? And building the kind of trust with those customers that I've delivered good service to you before and you can depend on us to take your point of view into account is critical to being given permission to implement transformational change.
And that's what you were talking about in the earlier segment around how important it is to get your to understand transformation from the eyes of the customers, the various part different constituencies within an agency. It doesn't have to be the notion of customers within the Postal Service. It could be, you know, citizens within a different agency. How important that is.
Yeah, and I think you bring up a point that is very interesting that goes back to this idea of mission value. So Pat Donahoe, as you mentioned, has been notable for his capacity to sustain service, but also to cut the budget, which was the responsibility of his previous job, which was chief operating officer and deputy postmaster general. Now he's the postmaster general, and he's responsible for the top line, too, the revenue generation. And you can see in a case like his that delivering service and sustaining these customer loyalty is going to be critical to delivering that top line, continuing to deliver revenue to the Postal Service.
So, Bob, you mentioned you had an opportunity to speak with Richard Spires, the CIO of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. And what did you folks talk about in regards to transformational leadership in his area? You mentioned best practices. He's bringing private sector best practices in, as a sort of way to change and to create a culture in DHS and the CIO shops that drives performance. Could you elaborate?
Well, I think that in Richard's case, Richard has a deep experience in the private sector as well as experience in IRS and at Homeland Security. And I think that one of the things that he's found is a very useful driver for creating collaboration and building a team that has a common view when you have many diverse different agencies is the idea that you can bring to the agency a vision for cloud computing, for data consolidation of data centers, a notion that big data is going to be something that's very important to the agency. So these are all thoughts that have to do with what people that have been following the technology evolution closely, you know, would say are front of mind considerations today. And it's by his facility to be able to bring those best practices to the conversation that I think he's been able to get cooperation, collaboration in ways that are very important to being able to implement change.
In your conversation with Richard, did you talk about the fact that given the size of DHS, that certain things needed to be a little different than when it was at the IRS? I mean, the idea of size versus the messaging or the management practices that he instilled.
One thing, and this goes back to another point that we've talked about, which is the value of it's not so much a tactic, it's such a core element of this process, but the importance of mission and to having a clear definition of mission. Now, in the case of DHS, they had a quadrennial review that in which the secretary declared five missions for the agency. And just even seeing those five missions, which start with protecting against terrorism, but also have a major component having to do with border security and immigration, and also have to do with emergency response and even anticipating the future, which is cybersecurity, that you can see the kind of mixture of missions across that enormous agency and how important it is to have a clear sense for what are the priorities of the agency in order to begin to deliver on value.
Now, the Federal Student Aid Program is a very unique federal program. And I know that you've had the opportunity to speak with Bill Taggart, who's the former FSA Chief Operating Officer. And he came to the FSA at a time of a lot of reassessment and rebuilding. Can you tell us a little bit about his critical focus during his time at FSA, and what was he really majoring on?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want to think that I had one takeaway from any of these people, because they brought such diverse experience and they were responsible for many different things. But in Bill Taggart's case, he taught me something that I hadn't seen before, which was that given the nature of the change, how fundamental the change may be in an individual agency, it may be necessary to begin at a much more basic level with individuals and with defining mission and defining goals at the level and drawing in the individuals in the agency. So the anecdote that I think is applicable here is that as he talked about what had happened at the agency before, you could see how much change was taking place. There had been scandal and there'd been difficulty like that. But even more than that, there was new legislation that resulted from that. And the new legislation had led to a fundamental repositioning of the banks and the role that the banks would have along with the department in issuing the loans. So as you change those critical variables, you're bringing in new stakeholders, you're getting people to change what it is that they did before, you're changing the incentives that are necessary in a public-private partnership that has to take place at FSA. And so when he talked about that fundamental change and the shocks that the agency had received by having to make those changes, he talked about beginning at the level of meeting the senior staff and their families and talking through with them their vision of the mission and kind of what a mission statement would look like in that kind of a context. And what I took away from that was that the more fundamental the shock, the more personal transformation may need to be.
So he did that in a very personal way to interact with the various stakeholders.
And that's right. Both stakeholders as well as the internal staff and employees. But essentially the nature of the loans made to students was going to change because of the law, the new law. And essentially he was engaged in a process of repositioning the agency, but having them help him do it.
So, Bob, you had an opportunity also to speak to Roger Baker, who is the CIO of the Department of Veteran Affairs. What did you learn from Mr. Baker about his efforts to transform VA's IT services infrastructure? And to what extent did his view of transformation emphasize mentoring and training as an approach?
Well, in each of these agencies where I got the opportunity to talk and where people ask questions and where people shared their time with me are so different from one another that it's really quite striking. And so the Department of Veterans Affairs is an enormous, of course, agency. It has a structure that is divided into areas that are unlike the areas of some other federal agencies, particularly when you're talking about something like medical records, which is a critical concern of the VA. It's important to get collaboration and to, as people are beginning to explore what health information and the transfer of health information is all about. The idea that health data and transforming the management of patient records would be a critical cost saver is something that's right at the core of many of the healthcare reform debates of the last decade. And so it's very important to begin to help veterans manage their own records and to begin to make that transfer. As they interact with the private sector and with veterans' hospitals and with areas, you can imagine that there are so many handoffs and so much collaboration that's required that I was struck by Roger's emphasis on mentoring and building a team. He had, when I was with him, someone shadowing him, and that person changed every 2 weeks. He was bringing in new people to spend the day with him, watching what the CIO at the departmental level's job is, and to begin to take that understanding back to the field where they had their own IT responsibilities. Now, that kind of shared understanding builds certainly the structure over time, and I think was a tactic that I think is probably pretty effective.
Well, Bob, I very much appreciate your spending the time with us today to talk about your report, and in particular bringing out these very rich examples of the various elements of the playbook that you talk about in your report. Could you tell us a little bit about how those parts of the playbook really offer a foundation to building the overall structures to anticipate really the future and transformation in government agencies?
Well, when we've talked here today, it's clear that each of these agencies are so different from one another and face situations that are totally different. The idea of the Postal Service and its challenges with costs and continuing to deliver service, the Treasury Department taking on new missions for consumer protection, the Veterans Administration managing health records, and the list goes on. As these agencies are so different from one another, it becomes clear, while everyone may share limited resources and the need to make change, to adapt to provide new choices, in spite of those shared things, everyone's different. And so everyone needs to have their own game plan, their own strategy for how they implement transformation. In some cases, the nature of the innovation may require much more preparation. It may require more time. It may require building capacity and infrastructure and capabilities among employees. In other cases, it may be quick, and it may be possible to take things on in a much faster pace or necessary to do that. So the idea of a playbook and being able to write something that reflected what people were telling me about their views of the best tactics from their point of view really offers a playbook that others can draw from in creating their own game plan, recognizing that every game plan is going to have to be different and individual.
So, Bob, by the end of the year, we will either have a new administration or the start of the next Obama administration. What insights would you like to offer current and future government leaders based on your research? And more particularly, how can these recommendations that are outlined in your report assist future government executives?
Well, one of the interesting things here is that we've been talking about this word transformation for a long time. There are examples that go back a decade, and there are many stories. Postal transformation that led to postal reform, and we're still struggling with some issues there. The Postmaster General is the first one to say that. DOD transformation is a topic that has had many pieces to it. The Government Accountability Office emerged from a transformation process that David Walker directed. VA health